episode 2 of the Hear Us Out podcast. Today, we're excited to have performer and our friend, Stephen Kellogg.
A Stephen Kellogg performance is like watching Ted Lasso live. Whether he's playing music or doing stand-up, his shows leave people inspired and restored. For more than 2 decades, this wordsmith, TEDx speaker, stand-up comic, author, and troubadour has delighted audiences around the world. Planet Bluegrass calls him a first-class songwriter with a poet's gift for fresh imagery. And Counting Crows frontman Adam Duritz says of Kellogg, "There are few people in rock and roll who are just so great."
He's received the Armed Forces Entertainer of the Year Award and has had his work nominated for a Grammy. Rolling Stone magazine describes his sound as John Prine fronting the Heartbreakers. The recent sit-down and stand-up tour was a one-man show that opened to rave reviews from fans and critics alike. A mix of music, humor, and storytelling, each performance paints a unique canvas that covers the full spectrum of human emotions. You'll laugh, cry, and you'll go home with a full heart. And in our experience with Stephen Kellogg, we certainly have.
So at the end of episode 1, I said that we would tell you the story of how we connected because it really was a feel-good story. So why don't you start with that?
So back in 2021, we went to a Toad the Wet Sprocket show where Stephen Kellogg was the opening act. And he came out, sang a couple songs before the main act came out. When he came out, there was something special about him in that he was able to convey storytelling through song in a way that I think most songwriters or singers can't necessarily do in the same way or have the same touch. So whether he was telling a personal anecdote story through his song or whether it was more global and representative of the average human story, he spoke to each of us individually. There was something that stuck with us through that. I think something that we have found with Stephen Kellogg's shows is that he brings us to life. There's this feeling of aliveness.
Yeah, I think that when the show ends, you feel good. You wanted more. Yeah. And that's really a nice thing with a performance. And his lyrics, his storytelling, he had a way of holding on to the audience and keeping the audience engaged that felt unique. It was something that I really appreciated.
Yeah. And then we actually had the opportunity to speak to him later that night.
Yeah. So at the end of the show, he went out to the merch table so that he could chat with the audience. And we spent a few moments talking with him. And we were talking about acoustic guitars. And he's a Gibson guy. And I like acoustic guitars. So it's a few minutes of conversation. But I really appreciated that he took the time. And he just seemed like a really nice guy, a kind guy.
And it was backed up by, it sounded like various musicians that he's worked with have all described him in that same way. So it's really nice that when you talk to him personally, that proves to be true.
Yeah, there's a couple people that we know in common and everybody speaks very highly of him and yeah, in the same way. So there's something consistent in people speaking positively about him.
And then we got to work with him a little bit afterwards.
Yes. So we were looking to grow our work with musicians. And there was something about the way he engaged with the audience that felt accessible. So I said, why don't we try DMing him on Instagram? And we did. And we offered to make him a set of in-ear monitors and just asked him to give us a shout out and let people know that we were the ones who did it for him.
He's one of those people that actually runs his own Instagram account. So we knew we were talking to him personally.
Yeah. And we coordinated a time for him to come in. So he came to our office. We took the ear impressions and it was kind of unpleasant for him and that we made him suffer through three sets of ear impressions, which we've ever had them before. You really don't want three sets, but whenever it comes to in-ears, I do like to send 2 sets off to the lab so that they make sure they have everything that they need to make a well-fitting monitor. And because he doesn't live near us, I wanted to make sure we had an extra set just in case anything went wrong, anything got lost in the mail.
Always take the safe route when it comes to a celebrity.
Yeah, whatever could go wrong, we just wanted to make sure we were covered. So now we want to welcome Stephen Kellogg to the Hear Us Out podcast. Stephen Kellogg, welcome to the Hear Us Out podcast. Thank you so much for taking your time to meet with us today. It seems like right now is a really exciting time for you. Why don't you tell us a bit about what you're working on?
I like it. The use of the word exciting is the right adjective to use it because sometimes I substitute overwhelmed for that. It's an overwhelming time. There's a few things going on. We're going to be shooting a stand-up comedy special in October. So that is not something that I have done in until last year in my life. So this is bold slash crazy. There's always two sides to the coin.
Absolutely.
And then I'm working on a record. And then I've got a pretty extensive tour that starts in about a week. So, the three of those things with the occasional speaking gig. I'm speaking at Fidelity next week to a group of managers about storytelling. We're doing a workshop. Very exciting stuff.
You really
Also,
don't give yourself a vacation, do you?
well, it's just like if I knew how to do any of these things without having to, it's sort of like if you guys had like three other kind of related jobs to your ear thing, and you're like, I'm gonna try to do all of these. It doesn't feel like intelligent planning. I'll say that. It's a little nutty, but
Too busy now.
it's fun, and it is fun and it's fulfilling, and that's why I do it. So yeah.
You just mentioned working on a new record. Is that full band with other musicians or solo?
Yeah, that's full band, and I've started it. Different collections of musicians for different songs, but I love playing solo live because it really allows me to drill down to the song and the story behind the song. And but musically, I always hear music with other sounds than just my voice and guitar kind of thing.
You started off exclusively as a musician, and depending on where you go, what venue you perform at, the people you're performing for, you don't stick to a very rigid set list. You change it from night to night. Sometimes you're solo, sometimes you're with a band, other times you're with one other musician. With adding comedy into the mix, is it as rigid a set list where you keep to the same set every night, or do you also are you on the fly and are flexible with that?
Well, Michelle, I fully intended. I thought with comedy, I have to stay. I don't have that many jokes. I don't, song music, I have years of songs. It's easy to switch it around. I thought I'm gonna stick to the set list with the comedy. And then as soon as I got out there, I just the same impulse in me kicked in, that loves to mix it up. And I started mixing it up and telling different jokes and telling jokes different ways and mixing the order of things. And I think it's because I think it's because when you do the same thing every night, I can totally see the merits of it and why people do it, because you can slowly perfect it, and that there's that's each his own. But what I find is then I start to compare aspects of the shows that aren't authentic, like oh, the audience clapped louder last night or laughed harder or something like that, which is not really something that I can completely control. Like it doesn't feel enjoyable to do that to me. What feels better is to wake up and go, what do I need to say today? What is the most useful thing I can do today that will be beneficial to the audience and give them something that they'll never see again? Like, how do we make a fresh canvas every night, And to do that, I think you need to leave it a little loose.
When you're thinking about a set list, is it what you want out of the night, or is it what you think the audience wants or even needs out of the night?
It's a combination of both for sure, But the reality is, I don't know the audience. I might know a couple of people in the crowd or something, but I don't know exactly who's going to be there. But I can feel sort of the temperature of the city and the moment in time and and I do think about that. And sometimes you wake up and you're exhausted, and you think like, wow, I'm not going to be able to go out there and just pretend. I don't want to go pretend that I'm not exhausted, or that pretend that I'm not amped about something, or some of the best shows are if I'm going through something in that day or that moment, it becomes this incredibly cathartic event. And I feel like when you share, when you really are willing to share what's going on, I find that other people then go, man, I'm kind of in the same boat right now or something. And good things can come out of that, because the solidarity and the feeling of companionship happens at the show, which I think is a big part of what we're selling, you know, with this show. It's not.
I'm here on a job site with Tim, who owns his own electrical contracting business.
3 employees and 2 work trucks.
Tim traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance. We're positively here where he needs us most.
They sure are.
With step-by-step help on all his insurance needs, all for shockingly low rates.
Shockingly low, huh?
Just a little bit of electrician humor. Do you get it?
I got it.
You know, it feels like we have a real connection. All right, I'll stop.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Really, like, come hear me sing with my many octave voice, or what, you know, I'm not going to play some guitar solo that's going to change the world, but what I do try to do is be really get as open as I can with where things are at. And that requires, like, not faking it. You know what I mean?
We as the audience have, as audience members to many of your shows, have felt that.
It was interesting you say that. I think it was in Philly, maybe 2022. You had mentioned someone from your kids'
the same show.
You had mentioned someone from your kids' school that had just recently died, and you dedicated a song to them. It was really a deep, moving moment. And I feel like that captures what you were describing there. That's what was going on. That's what was real for you. So that's what you're giving to the audience.
It was impactful because as you were speaking, Eric and I were thinking of the exact same show, of this same moment. I think you started tearing up on stage, and we felt that.
Yeah. And I mean, getting that emotional is sort of, it would be a little embarrassing to me if it wasn't, if I had any option in it. You know, it's like, that's where it was. And that's not for everybody. You know, some people want to go out, have a good time. They don't want to hear about the world as it stands that day. And I respect that. That's one of the uses of music, you know, lose yourself in the music, you know. But I also just, that's not who I am as an artist, you know? So I go out there and I have faith, and, you know, a lot of times those shows, are the ones you end up remembering later on, you know, 'cause something happened like that. I do remember that Philly show. We lost Bruce Lazar, and I played my old song, "It's Only That I Miss You," which is like one of those ones you're like, am I really going to do this right now? Cause this is going to feel like something, you know, but no regrets. No?
Speaking about vulnerability on stage, when I'm in the audience, one thing I kind of like to look at is what's happening that either is not intended for the audience to see, or kind of on a deeper level, what's happening on stage. I was thinking of the idea of music versus comedy. When you're playing music, you have a guitar. There's this physical something that's between you and your audience. When you're doing comedy or telling a joke, it's you and it's the audience. Does that feel different for you? Is there some sort of armor that the guitar gives you?
No, I think that's really super perceptive, you know, Eric. I think the guitar does provide a layer of protection, and it's a little bit, it feels, they both things feel like a tightrope walk a little bit. But when the guitar's not there and you're telling jokes, it's a little bit like that someone just pulled the safety net out, because if someone's not enjoying music, there's no, you can kind of read like, oh, they're not clapping hard, or their facial expression, but there's not the very clear indication of silence that could happen if you tell a joke that doesn't go. And honestly, like, that hasn't really, it's not like I've been out there bombing left and right. I've had jokes not work, you know, where people kind of like, you're like, that one needs, we got to figure out how to communicate more clearly, or maybe it's not as funny to other people, or you realize something is slightly more offensive than you thought it was, you know, all these things happen. And you need to give, I give standups a certain amount of grace, because they are out there like pressing buttons for the truth, you know? So yeah, you say some things sometimes that you're like, but that to me is sort of what's fun about it too. You push that envelope. Jim Gaffigan, who is one of the comedians I really enjoy, and someone I have a very much just an acquaintanceship with, but have known for a bunch of years now. And when I started doing stand-up, I reached out to him, and he was kind enough. Sorry, my email keeps going up, but he was kind enough to say, "All right, I can give you 5 minutes on the phone." So I was like, "Great, I appreciate that." And my phone rang one night, and I didn't recognize the number. Who picks up when you don't recognize the number? I mean, that's crazy. I mean, it's never anything but like spam of some kind. And I picked up and he's like, "Steven, it's Jim Gaffigan. I've got 5 minutes trying to keep my kids off screens. What can I help you with?" And I had sent him some of my comedy and he commented on it. So this is why it was like we were. And so I just went in and asked a lot of questions and he brought up the guitar and he said, "You know, are you going to have it up there with you? Because that will be a safety. You could always pivot back to the guitar and you got to think about how you're going to get from A to B, you know, and that guitar could really bail you out with that because people are expecting it." And I totally hear him and I think it was good advice. And yet I didn't want to leave the guitar in the mix because I didn't want people to ever think I was going to do something silly or funny with the guitar. Like, I have no interest in that. You know, we'll leave that to Adam Sandler and others. It's just not, I will always, the music will always be serious music and the stories I hope to keep light. And I just thought this would be a cool way to balance a show for a while, you know?
You had mentioned earlier about the idea of you being very open with your feelings. And on your website, I'll plug it for you, KelloggFamilyStore.com, where you have all your merch. One of the things in your merch is the serenades, so where people can request for you to perform your songs for a specific purpose or occasion. You're somebody who is very open and with acknowledging your feelings. Is there a particular serenade you've done that's been meaningful to you?
Good question. They're all neat in their own way. I mean, it's kind of like the show. You get it, and usually there's a little paragraph that someone has shared with you of, "Hey, here's where I'm at." And it blows your mind because some people are like, come to it very lightly. Like, it's my brother's birthday and he's your biggest fan. Can you play Start the Day Early? And you go, and you know, that's a fun spirit. And sometimes you come to it like, I just lost my husband and I'm buying this for myself. And you, in both cases, I really want to put as much of whatever I have in me at that moment that can meet that person where they're at, you know? So if it's like, this is going to be played at a celebration, no matter, you know, I want to bring all the energy I have to say, "Hey, thanks for listening all these years." And if someone's going through a really hard time, as much as it's possible, I want to look into the camera and let them know, I see you, I feel you, and thank you for allowing my music to be part of your healing process. You know, I take all of that so seriously, too seriously, maybe. I've been told by my managers occasionally that I'm a little intense.
Kind of as a piggyback to that, in our professional work, we have the privilege of becoming part of our patient's hearing journey, which I would say is really most captured by our patients that have a cochlear implant. Those patients are really disconnected from the auditory world, and then we get to be a part of bringing them back to hearing. And we become a part of their stories in a really rich and meaningful way. I'm curious, with your music, where you feel like you've become a part of somebody's story in a way that sticks with you and maybe becomes a reminder of why you do what you do.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I will answer that question. I mean, first, I just want to say, like, when someone has the implants, are they hearing for the first time or the first time in many years, or how does that work?
It really varies based on the individual. Maybe you've seen the videos on YouTube of the kids when they turn the cochlear implant on. Their eyes get wide and they're so reactive to the sound. They kind of look all over. A lot of our adult patients are looking for that moment and they don't necessarily get it. For the kids, think of it as though the sensory system is being activated. That was not getting any stimulation before. So they're getting this new stimulation. They don't know what it is. It becomes arousing for them. What am I experiencing? For our adult patients, a lot of them have had what we call progressive hearing loss over the years. This is where it gradually got worse and worse and worse to the point that communication was really isolating them. Their ability to communicate the way they wanted to just wasn't working. Then they get this implant. The sound isn't, it's not acoustic hearing like we have. It's an electrical stimulation. It sounds more robotic. You can go to YouTube and listen to simulations of what it sounds like, but it does allow people to hear. They hear differently, but they do hear. We have activations. That's the appointment where we first turn the cochlear implant on. We may be starting that appointment with pen and paper, and some of them are ending with us speaking to each other. It's a big, big change. For some patients, it takes a period of months, and for some patients, it's much quicker. But we get to help them get from a place where auditory communication is really not so functional to a place of, I can hear.
Even the hearing aid patients, which is a whole different realm, we've had plenty of patients say that it's changed their life because they've been so isolated, disconnected from society, from loved ones. And then gradually over time, as they get accustomed to hearing aids, they're able to interact with the world in a completely different way, or in a way that they once were able to, and they can now get back to it.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen that with my parents who recently got hearing aids, and my dad especially. It's like he's back. I think he was missing a lot, you know, it's pretty amazing too, because they're so small and they're not, you know, I think the vanity aspect was hard for him for a while. And now because it's so small, he's just like, you barely know it.
It's technology. These days, it's another type of technology that we need to integrate into our lives, and it gets to improve quality of life.
Thank you for doing that. I mean, that's cool that you guys bring it in. I've gotten to know you a little bit over the years since you set me up with some nice earplugs and all this in-ears and all this. But, you know, it's cool that you bring you, because I know on their journey too that they had a few doctors. And not all were, as empathetic or just understood that it was emotional for that. For my dad, it was it's an admission of aging and you've lost something, and it's when you get somebody who can bring, you know, understand that you're also going through an emotional journey. I just think it's cool. And since it's the first auditory podcast I've ever done, I'm like, I want to say thanks for that.
We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, it's really cool. And you know, as far as being a part of people's story, I think there have been parts really in the last 10 years where I've just had to realize that when that happens, that's why I'm doing it. Like I have done fine. I make a fine living, but it's not, you didn't do it to get rich, and I haven't gotten rich, and I might not get rich, and all of those things. Oddly, it's just like you just need to make some level of peace with those things when you can't be why you're doing it. You know, you have to be doing it for the ability to make a difference in someone's life. And so I wish I could tell you that I always thought that way. I didn't. But there came a moment probably in my mid-30s, about 10 years ago, where I was like, I'm always going to do this. And the reason I'm always going to do this is because I want my life to mean something. And the reason my life means something is because people share how the music has impacted them, or how a show has impacted them, or something I said or something I wrote. And so you makes you, that's what brings me back to the table. You know, if I wanted to just work insanely hard to knock out a very middle-class living, I'm sure there are other things I could do.
And speaking of things that you wrote.
Oh yes. Your book. So we both read your book, Objects in the Mirror, Thoughts of a Perfect Life from an Imperfect Person. What inspired you to write it in the first place?
I just wanted to, I really wanted to write a book. You know, a lot of people say that. I don't think those of us who have said that casually realize quite what goes into writing a book. It's a lot more involved than I gave it credit for being. But, you know, I sometimes feel, to be honest with you, I sometimes feel as though my music doesn't reach as far as I wish it did. because not everybody likes Americana singer-songwriter music. Some people do, and obviously plenty do. But I thought I had more to say than just, you know, than I was reaching. And so I thought, let me go into a different medium, which is the same reason that I sort of found myself doing some stand-up. You know, it's just like, we don't have to agree on what we like musically. These are just ideas and thoughts. And by putting them in the book form and doing an audible of it, I just knew that I could reach some people who might listen to different music than the kind that I make, you know?
In your book, one of the things that really stood out to me was when you wrote about your relationship with your grandfather. I also had a very close relationship with my grandfather. He was the best man at my wedding. He started the department at the university that I teach at. He was also the first president of the professional organization that I'm involved with. So I feel like in some ways, that relationship really is present for me in my work, in my life, and in the work that you do. I'm curious how that relationship affects and really informs you.
Yeah, that's awesome about your grandfather. I mean, I've got his picture over here on my desk. I keep this picture here in my office. This is him holding me as a little boy, you know? And so when I'm having a hard time, you know, or facing a challenge or something, I look at these pictures, you know, and I think of him and I think, what would he do? Well, if we were able to talk this through, how might it go? You know, because I think our dispositions are very similar. I think that he would have understood, you know, the way that I'm thinking or handling something. But I also think he was his own person. And so it's nice you can have this internal dialogue. Where you can problem solve by allowing them to, like, you know, their legacy to live in your life, you know? So that's a comfort. That's a comfort. And that's how it shows up for me, you know?
We've also seen with your show is that you mentioned your daughters a lot. They've sang with you. We've had you send them off to college. So what has their role played for you in your music, in your career?
Yeah, well, it's the family business in that sense, you know. It's they've grown up around it for many years, especially the older ones. There was always band guys here, and we were always making music late into the night. And they, you know, as I've gone more solo, I think my younger daughters, I wish they had that too, because I think it's a lot of fun to be able to share that adventure with them. You know, and now that they're older and they're sort of interested in all this, but sometimes they're not and they don't want to be. And I get in trouble for, you know, if I include a picture that I don't run by them on a post or something like that. And so we've had to, like, have family meetings and discuss that, because they still play music with me and they're a huge part of the inspiration. And the whole family is a very big part of the stand up. So I'm not trying to, like, you know, ruin their lives, but I got to make a living and this is what I know. And so it's very active. It changes on a day-to-day basis, but I do occasionally get slapped on the wrist for, you know, the way if I say too much or whatever, you know, and I do the best I can and they do too.
It's nice that you incorporate the whole family into your profession.
I love it. You know, my wife works on the family store with us. We fill orders together. The kids help. It's I say sometimes, like, for singer songwriter, we're like the pizza place in town that everybody, like, loves, and they got all the kids running around making the dough, and, like, well, that's kind of how we roll. You know, we're definitely all in here working to make it, and hopefully that will serve them well and not be something they regret down the line.
There was a post, I think, where you talked about how you initially connected with Adam Duritz. And I was thinking back to a couple summers ago when you toured with the Counting Crows. Here you are on stage with your musical heroes, and you have your daughter singing with you. And really, whether they'll admit it or not, you have a hero role for them. And there's this connection from your daughters to you and you to the band. I think there's something really meaningful in the way that music can weave its way through our lives. When I would see you performing with your daughters, I would look at that and just think, wow, that's really pretty cool.
I mean, to me, that's as good as it could ever. The moments where I was able to just like look to my left, see Adam and the band, and look to my right and see Sophia and Adeline, and a couple of nights, Noelle and Greta got out there too for hanging around with Counting Crows. And it was like, that's about as happy as I'm capable of being.
So I wanted to hear from you. I think it'll be very useful for the audience to hear. When we first talked about in-ears, there were some things that you were hesitant about or things you didn't like about them when you had previously worn them. I think it's important for audiologists that are listening to understand that there's a lot about in-ears that stage musicians do not like.
True. Yeah. Well, it doesn't always break down this way, but it breaks down I find that that drummers and bassists tend to prefer them more, because there's a, I don't know if it's just that they're primarily interested in the sub situation of the groove of what's happening there. Whereas, a singer, there's that air around your voice that makes it feel alive, And it's the bigger the venue you're singing, and in some ways the more you need the in-ears, but also, it's pretty thrilling when you don't have anything in your ears and you say hello into a mic and it sounds like hello. It's there's something that hits your adrenaline with that and that you can use. So learning to sing with ears is a little bit like taking your fingers, yes, and closing this part of your ear, and you feel like you're underwater,
We tell our hearing aid patients that all the time.
Yeah. I mean, it's like scuba diving and trying to learn to relax breathing, which is also something I think I would not be good at. Is something happening? Is someone going to jump up behind me? There's a lot you have to just like accept. You have to change sort of what you're doing, and you have to really, the other thing that in-ears requires is you've got to trust whoever is out there making the sound happen for you, because you can't hear the room in the same way. That's the hard part about it. The great part about it, once you get used to it, is you have clarity. So you're not going to oversing. You're not going to overplay. You're going to, you can actually, it's like listening to an album, a CD or something. It's like listening to your headphones and realizing, okay, wow, I can really hear where the harmonies are coming in and out, or, your ability to play better grows. And you can also communicate. A lot of bands, have a microphone on stage that they can talk to each other that doesn't go to the audience, where they can say, hey, can we do this a little faster? Or you can put a click track in there, a metronome, and that can help keep you in the groove. I mean, you can do a lot of cool stuff with them, and they can protect your hearing from the wild spikes and, the sub stuff can be very dangerous. You can feel it like tickle your ear sometimes. And you're like, oh, that is not correct. So there are some people take to them right away. Some people like myself, it really took me years and finding the right ears that can let some air into, now they have them with filters and such where you can get some of the room in there, which really helps, I find.
Yeah. And that was one of the things that we had initially talked about was, from our perspective, we talk about what is ideal as the audiologist to have you use for what's going to provide the safest environment for you. But ideally isn't necessarily what works. So we look for the compromise that the best option is the option you're going to wear. The best option is the option you're going to utilize. So what we came up with when we were discussing with what you needed was
hey, let's get two sets of filters. One is going to be a 9 dB filter, which your stage doesn't tend to be so loud. So you don't need a whole lot of sound attenuation to be safe. And then we gave you also the filters that were knocking everything out. So then you're really reliant on mixing in crowd noise into your sound mix to get that access to the audience. So there are ways to compromise to get artists what they need, but also trying to keep those ears safe.
Yeah. The one you're going to wear, that's great. That's a great approach. And for years, people who said, you got to do this, you got to do that, I don't want, it's like, yeah, but if you're standing on stage making your living by being good and feeling the crowd and you can't, you're just, you don't care. I mean, it's the same reason a football player plays on a sprained ankle. You're just like, I know this isn't good. You don't have to tell me this is bad for me. I'm just going to do it because this is who I am. And it's nice to work with you guys where you don't feel so judged for the odd, you know, you're like, I know I got to do better. You know, the other thing I didn't mention too that is great about the in-ears is you can move all around the stage and the sound doesn't change, which is huge. If you've got a stationary monitor, you don't have that capability. So it really is the professional way to learn and handle it and do it correctly. It's good for you and it's the right thing to do, you know.
Did you ever practice with your in-ears like prior to a tour to get accustomed to them and see how much mix volume you need in order to get what you need?
Yeah, I think that that's very necessary because you also don't know until you know, I would think, no, I don't need bass because, you know, I can feel the bass just rumbling in the house. Mm-hmm. But when you put bass in, it makes it clear and quieter. It's like you're not sort of responding, and there's latency, you know, there's a delay. So if you have it in your ear, there's not, and you're playing with the bass versus like feeling the brr, brr, something that's like happening. And that takes practice. I mean, just trial and error, being out on stage and not hearing each other properly. I have a niece who plays music. She's a young artist in LA. And I said, how did the gig go the other night? And she's like, oh, the sound was so wonky. And I said, sound was wonky equals 40% of the gigs I've ever done in my entire life. You know,
it's a huge percentage.
And I've been a professional 25 years and that's still the percentage. So, I mean, part of what you're learning how to do is play through funky sound, you know, that's not quite right. For whatever reason, it just increasingly with digital and stuff, you know, the capability of repeating your sound is better. But that's also that's Pearl Jam's reality. That's not necessarily any of us doing it in sort of mid-level. You know, I'm in a theater one night, a small club another night, outdoor another day with the band, you know. And I think when you're using ears with a band, it does take some real practice. Even for the rhythm section, who tends to enjoy the ears, mm-hmm. I think that, you know, I believe it takes a bit of practice for them to sing out and to do their, you know, to realize, to just know how to play in the same way, because there is a certain amount that's going away and you've just got to kind of do it with the ears, and then ideally you record it. You listen back and you say, what am I doing here? Oh, wow, I'm over-singing, I'm under-singing, I'm rushing, I'm, you know, pulling back. That's the work we do so that we can be good and have fun on stage, you know?
I think it's a really important perspective to hear because you have to be able to do what you do. And what you were talking about before with your fingers, we call that the occlusion effect. And that's one of the hardest things to overcome, especially for singers with monitors. And it requires a really well-fit monitor that can actually help you be a better singer and not strain your voice as much if it's fit properly.
Yeah. I wish I had right at the beginning, just sort of of the band stuff, committed to it. I mean, I put them in and pull them out, pull them in, pull them out. You know, and when I finally got used to them, we taped that entire tour, and it was the best the band had ever sounded. But we'd been together many, many years. It just, we played together once we fully committed. But you just need to know you're going to feel a little uncomfortable in the beginning, and you just got to kind of have faith that it's going to work out.
So thank you so much for your time. I think we took more of your time than we expected.
Oh, you guys, this is a blast.
You have so much good stuff to say. We have so much we always want to ask you.
I love it. I'm honored to that you're interested in having this conversation, guys. Really, thank you for your support and your support with my ears. And then for this, I think this is a great new endeavor, and I'm honored that you asked me to come on your show.
It's really been a pleasure. Hey, just as a final note, this past year, there was a death in the family. And one of the songs that really was part of that grieving process was Objects in the Mirror. So thank you for that.
You're very welcome.
We'll be at your next show.
I look forward to it, guys. I'll see you really soon.